Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with lighting designer Paul Miller. In addition to his extraordinary career, he has done everything, everywhere. You'll hear him talk about the variety of ways he has worked, where he has worked, and what he has done. Although, I think he doesn't mention in this interview that he is the person who has been lighting the Times Square New Year's Eve celebration for the last 16 years. He's here for the sixth season at the Oslo Repertory Company, and this year he's lighting not only the opening show, the musical Guys and Dolls, but two of the four repertory shows to follow. Listen to this story, the story of a man who first thought he was one thing, then he thought he might be something else, and then he found the thing he really is. And as he says, when you find the thing that doesn't sound like work, that's it. He's delightful, he's spontaneous, he's exuberant, he's charming. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are, not the person you sometimes pretend to be, not the person that you wish you were, not the person other people tell you you are, or the person you think other people want you to be, but the person you really are. And if you've been listening, you know I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do this because when you listen to people who make their living or their life with an art, you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And my interview today is with lighting designer Paul Miller. It took Paul a while, with some false starts, but he discovered who he really is, what he was meant to do, what is his thing. And when he did, he grabbed onto it with both hands and has made a career as you will hear him say later in the interview, as a freelancer, 35 years as a freelancer, this is pretty extraordinary. Anyway, he is charming, as I said, in the run-up, and he has a very interesting story. And also, it's long, and I didn't want to cut any more than I had to. So, without further ado, here now is lighting designer Paul Miller. Okay, so I'm here with Paul Miller, who is the lighting designer for Guys and Dolls. I heard you talk about the lighting plan,
yep.
Right? And I'd like you to talk about that. But I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Yep.
And it's clear that the art to which you are giving your life and at least now making some living is the art of lighting design. Is that correct?
Yes, and it's very generous for you to call it art, because sometimes I think it's kind of a craft. Because, you know, it doesn't stand on its own, like making a sculpture. Lighting design exists to support a greater work.
And so does directing, and so does writing.
Exactly.
And so
well,
does,
writing is its own sort of thing, I think.
Well, it depends.
An actual, original, creative
Yes, it does, thing. But in theater, it's quite often a collaboration.
Absolutely.
Right? It's a... Why don't
we'll fix that.
Right.
That's totally the joy, I think, of theater, is that the collaborative process that happens with everybody in the room. And
yeah.
Everybody's... The sum of the parts is greater than the individual pieces.
Yes, that's correct. But
yeah.
So for me... what you do is an art.
Well, I'll take it.
Yeah, good. You got it. So, okay, good. So, I have questions about the profession, about what it means to be a lighting designer, and also about this particular production. Mm-hmm. But I only ask one question, really, and it is, do you remember the very first time in your life that lighting, color, I don't know, sunshine, making things with... Right?
I sure do.
Oh, good. Tell me.
I grew up in Chicago. My parents were incredibly supportive of whatever I wanted to pursue, and so they took me to the theater, and my dad gave me tickets to the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and we did lots of different things. We would go to clubs and hear music acts. They were really great about exposing me to a lot of different things. One of the things that when I was quite young...
Quite young being?
I was probably in my teens, I would say. Mm-hmm. We would go into Chicago, and we would go to the Eric Crown Theater, which is this gigantic 5,000-seat theater, and we would see tours that came in. And I have a music background. I was at that point in my life. I thought my future was going to be in music.
I want to take you back to where music started.
That I don't really remember.
Did you play an instrument?
I played the piano.
Did you have lessons?
For a very, very long time. I wanted to play the violin. The deal with my mom was, we'll give you some piano lessons, we'll see how that goes, see if you have any aptitude or heart for music. And I started taking piano lessons. We didn't even own a piano. When I started, I would go to the neighbor's house because they had a crappy piano, and I would practice there. And I just never moved on from the piano to playing the violin. And I just
so
played the piano for a very long time.
Is that because you liked the piano?
I think I did like it. I worked hard at it for a while.
Okay, let's start again. And so you were 10, you were 12, you were 6?
I was 6 or 7, I
six
think.
Or 7?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like you start to invest time in something, and you just keep going because you've invested some time. I was just taking piano lessons.
Right.
Like I was taking tennis lessons. Like I was doing other things, like riding my bike.
Right.
It was a thing
right.
That sort of stuck. I happened to sight read fairly well. And so there were some things about playing the piano that came easy to me. I had a church job. Yeah, I was a music director for a couple of years. Not at 7, but when I got older. When I got older, I would play rehearsal piano for the summer theater program.
So you were pretty good.
I was pretty
and,
good.
Well, not only were you pretty good, but you were known for it. Otherwise, how do you get these things? Right?
Yeah, you know what? I had a couple music teachers that were very supportive that found opportunities for me with up at churches. At one point, I had a really great teacher, David Schrader. This is now I was in my teens. David Schrader, who was the principal keyboardist with the Chicago Symphony, and he took very few students, but I studied with him. And I thought for a while that I might go into church music because I had I just had a feel for that sort of period of, you know, the 18th century sort of.
This is very unusual music. For a, I don't know how old you are, but for when you were a teenager, for you to be having a feel for 18th century church music. I mean, no.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
you weren't playing rock and roll or whatever was popular when you were a kid.
You weren't
playing show music, for God's sake.
Well, you know what? I mean, I think my skill set, like, I was not good as a musician at improvising. If the note was on the page,
you could read it.
I could read it and I could play it. So there was something. Music from that time, which is very, you know, Mozart and Bach and all that, it's very specific. It's almost mathematical. It's very structured and it's very specific, and there were rules, and like that appealed to my nerdy math brain.
This is really interesting to me because you don't strike me as a guy who's particularly interested in rules and structure, but maybe I have that all wrong.
Well, I would say that. Jumping back and forth in time,
mm-hmm.
I think I'm a better lighting designer than I was a musician. And that's probably why. The other part of that is, what I think I really wanted to do was to be a conductor. And I didn't really know, I mean, at the time, you were sort of led to believe that the path to being a conductor was through an instrument. You had to play the violin, or you had to play the piano fluently, be very well, and sort of segue into being a conductor. Not many conductors, conductors that don't play anything.
Right, right.
So the only thing I knew how to play was the piano, so I was sort of on that path. I think I emotionally had a passion for being a conductor, but I didn't really, the path to that was not sort of clear to me, which is going to bring me back
to good.
Your original question about when I discovered the lighting.
Yes.
And here's what I think was a defining moment, actually. My dad had taken me to see a matinee of some tour that was at the Eric Crown Theater, and I remember sitting in that theater, which is quite enormous, and the house lights went out, and the overture started, and I couldn't even tell you what the show was, but the overture was kind of big and brassy. And from the back of the auditorium, a follow spot came on and hit the conductor in the back of the head. Like a razor-thin beam of light from, like, hundreds of feet away. Bam! And I thought, that just gave me goosebumps a little bit.
Mm.
I remember thinking, how exciting it must be to be that conductor in front of that orchestra at the end of this beam of light that looked like a physical object in the room. And then it kind of occurred to me, oh, maybe it's not the conductor. Maybe it's the light. The guy that turned that light on has all the power in this moment.
Wow.
Like, the conductor could be playing that in a rehearsal room.
Right.
What made that moment, what
dramatic.
Gave me goosebumps
yeah.
and made mm-hmm. it dramatic and theatrical was the guy that turned on the light. Maybe that's who I want to be.
Amazing.
Now, I didn't.
I know. You didn't make
the
leap.
Have a career change.
Right.
I
understand. I understand.
But
you
I remember
can,
that moment. Really
yeah, clearly. Though. Clearly.
And questioning white.
Wow,
like,
what's
is
that?
It like this guy? Or is it like that? I don't know.
And how old are you?
I probably had graduated high school.
So at this point, you're still thinking music.
Yeah.
So you graduated high school. Did you go to college?
Performance gave me tremendous anxiety. So I had, now it all seems ridiculous, but I wanted to be a pianist because the performance.
Or a conductor.
Gave me a great deal of anxiety. So, I mean, I thought, well, I'm just going to take a little bit of time. I'm going to take lessons. I'm going to study. I'll sort of bide my time before I sort of figure out what to do. So
okay, so now you understood then that you had performance anxiety?
Oh, yeah. I enjoyed my lessons, even if I didn't practice, even though I wasn't prepared. I did not like juries. You know, you have to do this thing in music school. You have to play juries.
Right.
I didn't, because I sight read fairly well. I had a difficult time memorizing, which had never seemed fair to me, that other musicians, like flute players, were allowed to play their juries and read their music, and pianists had to memorize their music. I thought that was fair.
It isn't fair.
No, it's totally wrong. I don't get it.
It's absurd.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
No.
Flute players playing one note at a time.
That's right.
It's not fair.
That's right. Okay, so you get out of high school and you're studying with these teachers, but you're not thinking of going to college to study?
I was buying a little bit of time to sort of figure it out, and then it was, you know, time to do something, and I living in a constant state of anxiety. And then somewhere along the line, I also had this idea. I was like, how will I actually make a living? I was old enough to start to think about, what am I really going to do? Like,
it's interesting. Your family is not saying, what are you going to do?
No. They never pushed me or questioned or took issue with any. I mean, I could have come home and said I wanted to be an astronaut or whatever.
I like to stop at this moment always to say, this is how you raise a child.
I a huge debt of gratitude for allowing me to
be yourself,
explore and make my own choices.
Yeah.
That were,
yeah,
not
and find
great.
Your, right.
And sometimes I changed paths. I don't have any. I remember saying to my mom at one point that I didn't think music was for me. I didn't think that I would be happy working alone in a practice room for 8 hours a day and being frustrated. I didn't think I had the discipline for that or the soul for that. And maybe I was going to go to the Goodman School of Drama and study design. And my recollection of that is, I was like, okay.
So I think your parents were unusual and that you were very lucky. Okay, so we have you at, what, something like 18, 17, 18, 19, and you're thinking maybe not music, maybe design? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
So did at some point, did you think, I'd like to do something in the theater?
During that time, you know, I was attended this community college, this junior college in Elgin for a while, and the theater
How did that happen?
Well, I was just, because I had to do
You had to go to school.
I had to go to school.
I got it, okay.
So there was a very modest little theater department, and I was close to those people because they were all connected to the music department, of course, and there was a lot of crossover, and they would do like a spring musical, and I didn't, sometimes I would play the piano in the pit, and then it would be like, well, somebody needs to like figure out some scenery, or, and I'd be like, oh, I have this great idea for how we would like make some cutout trees, and I'm going to make a deck and build the stage up. I mean, I was just sort of doing it. I was playing also, there was a summer theater program in Elgin that would do a musical, a Shakespeare play, and a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. That was their season. They would do one of each. And I was almost always in the Gilbert and Sullivan, and I would play the piano in the pit for the musical.
So did you audition for the Gilbert and Sullivan?
I auditioned, but I might have been the beneficiary of being like a bit of a favored student, a little bit of a teacher's pet, maybe.
Really?
Some departments. Yeah.
Can't imagine
yeah.
it. Right. So did you like being on stage? Is that, I mean,
I didn't know, you know, I actually loved being on stage in, you know, in the ensemble of the Gilbert and Sullivan stuff. Mm-hmm. Was sort of great fun.
So now you have entered the world of theater.
Yeah, was kind of doing it, but without thinking that it was going to be sort of a life choice. So actually, when I had this little crisis of confidence in a future in music, one of my music teachers said, well, if you aren't going to go into music, what would you do? I was like, well, I don't really know. He goes, well, let me just backtrack. The summer theater program, I would be in the Gilbert and Sullivan, and I would play the piano in the pit for the musical. And at the end of a couple summers, I was trying to get a summer job, and my music teacher advocated to the management of the theater to get me a job on the crew there. So I was kind of getting paid to do tech work. So when I had this crisis of confidence or faith in a music career, that music teacher said, well, you're kind of working in tech theater. Maybe there's something there that you can go to school for. The only place I'd ever really heard of was known at the time as the Goodman School of Drama. which was in Chicago, was a School of the Art Institute. So it was sort of in my backyard. I interviewed during the summer for the upcoming fall semester.
With any major in mind?
As a set designer.
As a set designer.
All because I had done a few things, yeah. And I had some drawings that I had done, and I had done some technical drawings of how I was going to build a stage, so it was like all I had. But I would do things like, I would design the scenery, quote-unquote design the scenery, and the lighting for the Miss Illinois America pageant, for example. And then I would design something, and then I would put it together myself, and then I would light it, and I would take pictures of it, so I had that kind of stuff. So I moved into Chicago. I switched majors, I guess, very quickly after I got there from scene design to lighting design. I felt like I knew more about scene design, but I found there was something. I was thinking about that fall spot at the Erie Crown, and it was like a thing that you couldn't hold in your hand, and it only existed in time for the moment that I was in the room with that light, and like it didn't last after that. There was something kind of profoundly poetic and sad at the same, but also exciting. So now I was a lighting designer. Chicago was really good to me. I was working a lot in theaters in Chicago. I was really into it.
Doing what?
Lighting shows.
Oh. So right away you start doing it.
I mean, little tiny...
No, I know. But right away you start doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Right away I started doing it, which you weren't really supposed to do when we were in school, actually.
But you liked it.
But I did like it. And I also was paying my way at school. I was paying my tuition and paying my rent by taking what I learned on Monday and going to the little crappy theater I was working at on Thursday and trying to make art with, like, four lights made out of coffee cans. And then, like, a lot of things conspired to... my dad had a very serious heart attack. My sister had some serious health problems. My personal life got complicated. I also, honestly, had gotten myself overextended. I was working a lot outside of school and maybe not being the best student ever. A theme that runs throughout my life.
Yes,
about being overextended.
Yes.
So, well, the way I like to put it is we mutually agreed to end our relationship.
I see, you parted ways.
We parted ways.
Yes.
I'm still very close to that school. I now participate a lot in alumni things and I give them money and I go talk to students when I'm there and they claim me as well.
I was just going to say.
They basically kicked me out.
Right, I was going to say and they could claim you now.
But,
that's great.
Yeah.
Right.
Like when you, it turns out that when you actually write checks every year, they like are happy to say you went there.
That you went there, right. I got it.
It was an amazing place to go to school. It was, you know, in Chicago, which is an amazing theater town.
Yes, yes. Well, and the other thing is you discovered what you wanted to do there and you learned enough to go out and do it there, right?
Yeah.
Right.
It's actually kind of true. When you find the thing that doesn't feel like work, like that's the thing. That is the thing. And it occurs to me that that doesn't happen to everyone.
That's right. That happens to damn few.
Yeah, as it turns out.
As it turns out. And part of the reason, I believe, is because few have parents who trust their children.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely.
You know.
And part of the gig is it's a freelance thing.
Yes.
I'm constantly looking for the next gig or like whatever. And I am into my 50s. And to be a self-employed freelancer for my entire life. And like the fear that the phone will stop ringing never really goes away. But now I'm fairly confident. Like I have been doing it for like 35 years. Feel like it's going to be okay. But when I think about that, I've lived in New York for 30 years. I have the trappings of an adult. I have health insurance. I have a pension.
Right. So there you are. You're parted ways. And you're working, apparently.
Yep.
And so you're in Chicago.
Yep.
So how do you wind up in New York?
I had been to New York a couple times. And I just loved the energy of New York. And I knew that that's where I wanted to be. Maybe 2 years after I ended my relationship with theater school. I had like a little job as a technical supervisor for a little municipal theater in the suburbs, and I was freelancing. I was doing well enough in Chicago. I had my own apartment. I bought a brand new car. I mean, I was doing well enough. And I woke up one day thinking, you know, I sort of would enjoy being like a small fish in a bigger pond. There's something about that that works for me. Mm. Not to say that I had conquered Chicago and I was like on top of the, I was not. I thought there was some sort of romance in the notion of like moving to New York and like finding, and just being whatever you wanted to be, that was the place to do it. I get a great deal of energy from being around people that look different and speak different languages and come from different parts of the world. I find that really exciting. Chicago, I mean, everybody looks like me, they sound like me. So I was old enough now to know that I had to have a little bit of a plan. So I was like, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to visit the people that I knew there. And I'm going to spend a week or maybe a week and a half and try to find a job. So that at least when I get off the plane, I have a gig for like, you know, to tide me over. The second day I was in New York, I'd gone to the office of this touring company that sent little bus and truck tours all over America. And the theater that I worked for in the suburbs frequently booked some of those tours. So I marched in there and I was like, hey, I'm Paul. I used to work at this theater when we used to bring your tours. And they're like, oh my gosh, we love going to your theater. You guys are so much fun and you're always prepared and like it always goes well there. And I said, well, I'm looking for a job because I want to move to New York. And they were like, well, as luck would have it, our lighting designer who tours with our shows is about to have a baby. So she's still going to design the shows, but she's not going to go on the road anymore. So if you want to go on the road, we would love to have you. And I was like, okay.
Right.
Done. Play, party for the rest of my vacation. I moved to New York and I had like a week or two to kill. I couch surfed at a friend's place. And then I went off as the lighting supervisor for this national tour of Cabaret for about a year. That was my first real job in New York.
Amazing.
What was great because I had not gotten an apartment yet. I had no expenses.
Right.
I had gotten rid of my car. I'd gotten rid of my cat. I got rid of my apartment in Chicago, and it was like me and a suitcase and on the road. So I was banking all that money. When the tour ended, everybody flew back. And I remember waiting for our luggage, and everybody was like, oh, wow, I'm so excited to go home. I can't wait to get back to my apartment. And I was like,
uh-oh.
I can't believe I hadn't thought about this moment. I literally have nowhere to go. I do not, and I didn't think about it until right that moment. But I'd made many friends on the tour, and, you know, somebody was like, oh, you know, come stay with me, and oh, I'm doing this summer stock gig next month, and maybe we'll get you. It was a great experience because I met my first circle of people and contacts. Also, I went to 48 states and worked in a different theater, sometimes three different theaters every single week.
Oh my.
And dealt with whatever the crew or the situation was. So
you got the experience of a lifetime.
Absolutely.
Oh, and you got all that people not looking like you thing?
Oh, the luck got lots of that. Or thinking like me.
Yeah, right.
But I would find it hard to imagine ever walking into a situation I would not know how to deal with.
Yeah,
because really I've experienced lots of different things.
Okay, it could not have been better.
It could not
have been better.
I could never do that now. That's something you do in your 20s. So I do that tour, and right? then it's like I can't get a job because nobody really knows me. I had met some folks in Chicago connected to the musical called Nonsense, and I had gotten a job working on that production, and I met all those folks, and I really liked them. So when I moved to New York after that tour ended, I was kind of looking for a job, and some of my Nonsense friends were like, oh, you know, the show is running off-Broadway, and if you, you know, are looking for a job, our electrician who runs the lights is going to go do something else for a while if you want to sub and come in and run the show. So I did that. I was very grateful to that because my survival job was like in show business.
Yes.
For $265 a week or whatever. I mean, whatever it was. That opportunity, and I ended up being there for quite a long time, and I came and went. When I got other jobs, they'd let me go, and then I would come back. I eventually became the assistant stage manager there, and I stage managed the show for a time, And is also as a result of that, I sort of became the family lighting designer, so I lit Nonsense all over the place as a result of that connection. I didn't want to get a survival job. I didn't want to be a temp, and I didn't want to do something that would get me stuck. I had already sort of witnessed people that moved to New York that got survival jobs.
And then they just stayed there.
Because that job started to, it was harder and harder to leave that to go do a little summer stock show for like $500. You couldn't afford to do that. And so your survival job became your career, and I didn't want that to happen. I was like, I would rather eat ramen noodles for the rest of my life, but every day be able to say yes to
something
great. Any opportunity that came along, even if it didn't. And that served me really. That it was really scary.
I was going to say it was very brave. You don't have to take credit for that, but it was just the same.
I mean, I love that it could be interpreted that way. I mean, it also could be interpreted as not very smart and not very responsible. I mean, you know, it was very rough, and I think that there did come a point where I was like, well, this is not sustainable. I'm like into my 20s now, and like this is like bad news. Like I don't see my way forward. And then a random encounter. I went to see a show, a Broadway show, just on a whim. Bought a half-price ticket, and it was a preview for a new musical called Big. And I went, and I sat in the back of the theater, and I was aware that the lighting designer for that show was sitting across the aisle from me with his assistant and a notepad, and they were working on the show. And the show was terrible, actually. And I was really not having a very good time that day, and I was like, when intermission came, I was going to just go home. So intermission came, the house lights came up, and I kind of leapt out of my seat. At the very same time that the lighting designer got out of it, so we ran into each other physically in the aisle. Excuse me, pardon me. I was like, you're Paul Gallo, aren't you? And he was like, yes. So I'm Paul Miller, I'm a lighting designer, I just moved to New York. He goes, oh, come to the sidewalk, come talk to me. So we're on the sidewalk, and I was just some kid that he physically bumped into in the aisle, who now he was treating like a colleague because I said I was a lighting designer.
Right.
Which was barely true. And we had this amazing conversation, and he kind of pushed me. I was trying to be very polite, and he pushed me to express my opinions about what I had just seen. And kind of broke me down, and we just sort of hit it off. And then skip ahead maybe 6 months, I don't know, maybe 9 months. I was freelancing and making work. I was doing what I call Theater of the Black Cube, like six lights, black rehearsal cubes in the back of a bar in Soho, like, you know, getting paid $500. I was somehow making that work. And I got a call from Paul Gallo's office. And at the time, Paul Gallo was the biggest, most important lighting designer. Every gigantic new musical that was invented on Broadway, Paul Gallo was the guy to light that. He was a really big deal. And his office called and said, Paul would like to talk to you about coming in to work for him this summer. We have a thing coming up. And what's it called? I couldn't possibly. I'm lighting summer stock in Michigan for $150 a week this summer, so I couldn't possibly assist Mr. Gallo. Thank you so much. Right. So I would relay that to my friends who were also
Did
like,
you actually say that?
I basically did. And they were like, what is wrong with you? I was like, was that bad? Like, I'm doing my own work. I'm like designing. I was, and they were like, yeah, for $150. Like, this is like Broadway actually called you.
You right.
So, as luck would have it, he called me back a week later. He goes, I know you got your own work. That's cool. Just come in and talk to me. Just come in and hang out. And I went up to his office on 110th Street and spent all day there. And we had the most... And I don't even think we talked about... We certainly didn't talk about lighting. And I don't think we talked about theater. But we had the most engaged, passionate conversation about like the world and like I don't even know what we talked about, but we didn't talk about lights and we didn't talk about career stuff. We were just like People. And at the end, like, it was, the sun was going down, and I was like, I just want to be around people like this, that, mm-hmm. like, make, like, who, I don't know, it was weird. And he said, look, I respect that you know, you're older than most assistants. You've been around a little bit. He goes, I find that really appealing. You're like, in air quotes, a grown up. I would love to have you come work on our team, and we'll figure it out. And if you've got stuff you got to do. And so I worked on a little show with him that he had taken over, and we did in London, and then we did a US tour of it. And then I was working in Florida. I was doing nonsense in Florida. And he called, and he said, oh, we just got the job lighting this new Broadway musical called Titanic, and you have to come back to New York right now. It's all hands on deck, so to speak. And that was my first big job on Broadway, assisting Paul Gallo on Titanic. And the thrill of working... It is very exciting to do Guys and Dolls. Yeah. It's very exciting. It's mm-hmm. a wonderful, well-made musical. But there have been 10,000 productions of Guys and Dolls.
Right.
We know the play works. Yeah. There's no conversations about, well, maybe this song should go here. Do you think this character, we should just... There's none of that. When you're doing a new musical, and every word on the page is in question and up for grabs, and songs, and like... And you're really making something from scratch. Well, I'm not. I'm just helping the people make this thing from scratch. It is... overwhelmingly exciting. It is like a drug. It's so exciting. And I was told it would be sort of like a trap once you sort of got into that world. You would be so addicted to that energy rush. And it's totally true. And there's not very many places where you can sort of do that and experience that. And I remember 3 years later going to do Summer Stock somewhere. And at the time... kids had like Walkman or CD players and cases of CDs, and I remember everybody had the young actors had their cases with show cast recordings, and there was Titanic, and there were all these musicals that I'd worked on, and I was like, I have a little place in a little tiny slice of the timeline of the American musical theater. I mean, I was there when that musical was made, and now kids are listening to it on their Walkman mm-hmm. and dreaming of being in show business. I'm super proud of that. Super proud of that.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit about Guys and Dolls.
Yeah.
And also that thing that you were talking about the light plan and how you get to do it now and then people have to use your light plan.
I love that.
I love that.
So here at Oslo...
Because I never heard...
How that works.
Yeah, right.
A lot of people have
right.
no idea.
No.
Well, you know, first of all, just the room.
Right.
The theater... is very, there's something in there all the time. It's a very busy room. The ballet is in there, the rep is in there.
Oh,
there's
right.
like lots
mm-hmm.
of things that
right.
go on in that room. So at the Oslo, the season starts in the fall with a musical. In this case, it's Guys and Dolls. And then that's followed by what used to be 5 show, now it's a 4 show repertory season. And it's truly daily rep. We do one play on a Saturday matinee, and then the crew takes it all down, they put the other show up, and they do a different play Saturday night. It's very exciting. There's not very many theaters in the country that do that.
For good reason.
For very good reason. Very exciting for the audience, though. You could come for like a 4-day weekend to Sarasota and see like 4 plays.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. So, in order to make that possible, when we do like Guys and Dolls, I got drawings way back in the spring. I got drawings of the scenic design, ground plans, sketches, elevations, color samples of what it was going to look like. And I prepared a lighting plan after I spoke to the director and the set designer. And I decided what kind of lighting fixture would go in every different position, where I would put them, what their purpose was, what they were going to do, if it was going to light this piece of scenery, be used for this scene, how it all got connected together. I drew that in a very technical drawing that the electricians here then hang all those lights, maybe there's 300 of them, in the air, And then I come in, and then every light, you have to go to every single light and point it in the appropriate place that I've been thinking about since February, and adjust it and finesse it and then secure it so it doesn't move. And then we begin the process of tech, where we start to work through the play very, 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 very slowly. And like, okay, this moment, my plan was to turn these lights on and turn these lights on. And there's a fall spot, and that looks good here. And then so the actor moves over here, so now I need to turn these lights on. And you work your way. You take 4 or 5 days to work your way through the play. Now, and I've squeezed lights in everywhere. There's nowhere to put another light. So now if you're doing daily rep, and you basically have to squeeze 4 plays into the theater and turn them over in like 3 hours, you can't keep changing the light plot. It's not possible. And you can't hang 4 light plots because there's not enough room. So you have to make a light plot, a lighting plan that kind of works for everybody.
So are you saying that you knew what was coming next, or that there is a light plan that works for everybody? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yes. Well, if you have a light plot that I've custom made just to do
for guys and dolls, right?
Which has very specific colors and choices in it, it's pretty easy because I can do whatever. It's like, oh, move that light over there. Let's change the color of that. Like, I want to point that light over here. If you have a rep lighting plan that four plays have to use, if the first guy comes in and lights his play and there's a light pointed here that he uses, and the second guy comes in and uses that light in his play, the third guy can't come in and point it over here.
No.
Because he's just screwed over the first two guys.
Right. Because they're going to have to come back in.
That's right.
Right.
So it has to be sort of a one-size-fits-all thing, which is incredibly challenging.
So are you saying that you knew what the other 4 plays were? Or?
Oh, yes, I do know. There are 4 plays in the rep season. I know what they are, and I have seen design drawings for all of those. The 2 of those plays, I'm actually the lighting designer for.
Oh, how nice.
Very convenient for me.
Yes, right.
Now, the other 2 plays in the rep season, there are other lighting designers. So I try to get them on board. Like, hey, I'm laying out the rep plot, and I want to be sure that when you get here, you can succeed.
Yes, you can use it.
And you can use it, and it's useful to you. So I was going to make all the light from the side, I was going to make it orange because that works for me. And they'll be like, oh, no, I can't do that. I was like, okay. So
wait a minute. Well, orange would work.
I just made that up.
All right, but it would work for guys and dolls. And
It would work for guys and dolls.
Yes, it would, right. But maybe not for little foxes. Right.
So then we have to sort of compromise and figure out what choices we can make that will kind of work for everybody. So it's really challenging. Right. But it's really nice when you have the ability to more completely realize the vision that you have, even in the rep situation. One of the things that's helped here is we've added a lot of technology to the lighting. So we have automated lighting fixtures and things that change colors and things that can serve multiple purposes. A great example is in Guys and Dolls, there's a scene that takes place in the sewer. And there are these 6 giant, very graphic portals that are, well, green. And I had this notion that I would want to light these dancers with a little bit of green light. That's a really specific choice that does not work in the rest of the play. So,
or with the rest of the other plays.
Or anybody else.
Right, right, right.
So there's not room to hang 12 lights with green gel on them.
Just
for this one moment.
Right.
So, in the olden days,
a glimpse of stocking,
this moment would not have been able to be lit that way. With the very generous support of some donors, we were able to purchase some light fixtures. I can turn them any color I want.
Oh.
So, we put those, it's one set of lights, and I can make them slightly green for Guys and Dolls, and put on stage the story and the idea that we've been talking about for months, which I think is better storytelling and more supportive of that moment in Guys and Dolls, and we wouldn't have been able to do that before.
That's very exciting.
It's
really
cool.
It must be so wonderful for you.
It's really cool.
Because I'm thinking that if you're doing rep, you're constrained.
Absolutely.
Right.
And you were still constrained,
yes.
But like technology has removed some
of the constraints. Right. But because this is your vision, it must be so exciting when you can do whatever
when
you want.
Kind of do what's in
right. Yeah.
Area.
Right. What you see.
I think it's really cool to go back and look at photos, or if you were here and saw like last season, if you saw all of the plays that were in the rep season, they really do look remarkably different from each other. And, I mean, these are very talented designers that come here, besides myself, of course. They all have sort of slightly different approaches or tastes. So the way I would turn on a fixed set of lights is going to be different.
Yeah.
The next person come into the very same lighting rig and just turn it on in a different way.
Yeah.
And the more we can do to make that light plot and that rig flexible, more opportunities there are for people to, like, try stuff.
Yeah, but you see, this is what art is. Sorry.
You win. Yeah, no, it is.
You know, I mean, because it's not only lighting directors. Directors and composers and arrangers,
yeah.
I mean, they don't do the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, this arranger wants to use flutes
yeah.
here, but this one wants to use, you know, trumpets
yeah,
here, and right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The real meat and potatoes of our process happens at the last minute in the room. Like,
oh.
And it doesn't mean anything until the set's there and
mm-hmm.
the actors are
right,
there.
Right.
I drew a technical drawing of where lights should go. There's no actual light in the air until, like, 3 days ago.
Yeah.
So you really have to be into living without a net.
Yes.
Being sure that you have options, being sure that you're prepared for whatever might come up, what you see in the rehearsal room and what happens on stage, and then make some big choices in front of a room full of people who are waiting for you to make some choices
right.
and make it look beautiful or tell the story.
Right.
And they may go, oh, that's amazing. That looks fantastic. Like, yeah, that's not what I was thinking.
Yeah, right.
And you gotta have another plan.
You know, I love this. I love this because you didn't want to be a musician because
you know when we were talking about that,
right.
I thought it's so funny that performance anxiety,
right.
which seems so physical to me,
right.
than about
right.
playing the piano,
right?
Like this kind of pressure,
right.
some people find crippling.
Yes,
I find it exhilarating.
It's fascinating, but it's what you said when you find it. It's yours, right?
I get so excited, especially like in a musical. You know, we set up tables for computers and our paperwork and tech tables during the process.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we sit in seats and it's like basically your desk and you're at work and the stage is there and you have a headset and you're working. But I almost invariably end up standing up. And like
yes, right.
Gesticulating with my hands.
Right, getting
like conducting.
Yeah,
like
yeah, that's right. You did. Why? You wound up. Oh my God.
Look, come and see what I did there.
Yeah.
See what I did?
It's great.
So it's really, I do find it, and I do have tremendous anxiety the day before tech starts. I'm like, this is going to be a disaster. Like, I'm not going to be able to.
It doesn't matter how many times you've done it, right? Oh, it's fascinating.
Apparently not. I'm like, oh, this is going to.
Yes, but the minute it starts, you're in it, right?
Art is not an. Again, I will.
Yeah, yeah, just leave it. Just leave it, right.
All great art has been a product of incredible labor and time and effort and tweaking and adjusting. It doesn't just sort of happen instantaneously. It doesn't just sort of flow out of you perfect and, like, finished. And so my favorite thing to say in tech is that, you know, lighting is a process. There's layers, and there's, like, little soldiers up there that I have to choreograph into the right arrangement for. Guys and Dolls has about 450 lighting. So 450 times during the course of 2 hours and 20 minutes, lights change in some way. And so each one of those states has to be finessed. I'm not blowing my own horn here. Like, I really can make an audience applaud in a place where they might not. I can make them not applaud by the way I manage a light cue.
Wow.
I can make a moment seem more romantic and emotional than it might be. It's amazing how, even if you're not aware of it, what our sense of vision
has and the impact it has on us.
Can communicate,
right? It's like the moment the light hit the conductor's head, and you were physically moved by
it. It's a very sort of quotidian thing that happened, but it hit me so hard.
I have one other question. You're doing this work now for 35 years, more or less.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh my gosh.
Okay, good. So, is there anything you would say about what that's like, or what that means to you, or what you would say about it?
First of all, gosh, the time goes by so fast.
You mean your life?
Yeah, in the career, and like it wouldn't even occur to me to call it a career. It hasn't been that long. I haven't been doing it that long. I'm just learning. I'm just like new. I'm starting out, but like 35 years, it's a long time.
It is a career.
It, as it turns out, it is. I am gigantically, enormously proud of supporting myself doing this. This is just a silly thing. I turn lights on and off.
I can't believe you're saying this on the heels of, I can make people feel and act. I can actually make their hands come together or not.
Well,
and then you want to say, I mean, really? Really? You don't... Well, I don't know. Is this just your inability to cop to the power of that, and so you want to make it less, or are you just shy?
I think, I'm trying to figure out if this is sort of weird self-deprecating modesty or something. I think if you love the theater, this is very important to you. Nobody doesn't do this knows who Jennifer Tipton is, like the mother of our art. Okay, I'm just going to go with the art thing. It takes a lifetime of experience to sort of refine your art and your taste and your sensibility and to be able to own it. And there shouldn't ever be a point where you think you have it all figured out, that you've done it all, you've solved all the problems, and nothing will ever challenge you. And if I ever woke up and was on my way to the first day of lighting for a show and was like, I got this, it's going to be fine, I'd probably be in trouble.
But again, it doesn't dissuade you. I don't hear you saying,
no.
So I don't want to do it, or it's too hard. No.
No. My, whatever little measure of success I've had, has a lot to do with, I've never really had a huge plan. I've come to many forks in the road, professionally and personally, and I've never felt like I had to adhere to some sort of expectation or plan. I just could take the choice that was more interesting or appealing at that moment or felt inevitable, and it's kind of worked out. Which is not to say that some of them weren't mistakes. I mean, certainly I made bad. But even then, I probably learned so much from those things. My mom always said, well, someday there's going to be a job that you really want, and it's going to be between you and someone that has a degree. So I love, with all due respect to my late mother, I kind of love now that I never really finished undergrad. No one has asked me anything about going to school.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Paul Miller.
Thank you so much. I'm flattered to have been asked.
You're delightful. So he never really had a plan, and even though his mother was convinced that he had to have a degree, he never really finished his undergraduate work. And he thought he was going to be in music, but then that didn't feel right. And then he thought maybe he'd be a scenic designer. And he thought that he knew more about scenic design than light, but light captured him. And as he said, and I have repeated, when you find the thing that doesn't feel like work, that's it. And he knew it. He knew it from the minute that that follow spot hit that conductor on the head. And he's made a life. These 35 years have sped by. And as he says, well, I guess it is actually a career. A career built on knowing who he is, what he needs, what he wants, and being willing to pursue it. This is, of course, the theme, the mission, the message of the Lynn Show, that it is possible to know who you are and to be who you are. And so if for some reason you don't know that and aren't being that and you want to talk to me about that, please go up on my website, thelynnshow.com. Email me any questions you might have. I'll be glad to answer you. So, as always, I hope you got something that you can use from this show. Something that inspired you or tickled you or amused you. Something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got